This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide. They're inconvenient, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're more or less 1 year out from the election of Donald Trump. And that election continues to raise a lot more questions than answers. Let's put it that way, at least for now. Last week, we saw the first charges come down from the Robert Mueller probe. And from what we gather, we've only seen the start. So I wanted to start with Jeffrey Toobin, who's been watching the investigation very, very closely for us. Jeff is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a legal analyst for CNN. Jeff, I'd like to begin by talking about the election last year, which is very much in the news by way of indictments.
Right.
I want to get a sense from you what you think that Robert Mueller has. I know some of it is conjecture, but where you think his strategy is going when you look at what happened early this week?
David, I also work in cable news, so conjecture is my business. I think in many respects, the most interesting thing that was said all week was something that came out in one of the papers, court papers that was unsealed in the Papadopoulos case, where the prosecutor said, in describing the case to the judge, this is a small part of a much larger investigation, which certainly suggests, unless the prosecutor is completely blowing smoke, which I doubt, that we're going to see a lot more cases. We're going to see more indictments. We're going to see more guilty pleas. And as for where that's going and how, I don't know. But I think, you know, Mueller certainly served notice this week that this is a major investigation that is far from over and may just be beginning.
When you look down the line at this, how vulnerable is the presidency of Donald Trump at this point? I'm not talking about the fates of Michael Flynn or Manafort or some of the others, Carter Page. Donald Trump, how vulnerable is he? What did this week's events indicate to you?
You know, for obvious reasons, I've been doing a lot of reading about Watergate. And one of the things that I think in the historical memory of Watergate doesn't get enough attention is that Richard Nixon, this Republican president, got into trouble when both houses of Congress were in the hands of the Democrats. And, you know, while it wasn't as polarized a partisan environment as it is now, Democrats had no brief for Richard Nixon. So you had Sam Ervin chairing the Watergate Senate Committee. You had Peter Rodino chairing the House Judiciary Committee. What's so different now—
Democrats all.
You're right, is that Trump's own party controls Congress. And I don't see any scenario, with perhaps one exception, where this House of Representatives will impeach Trump for anything. The only conceivable act that might trigger that would be if he fired Mueller. if he had to not only fire Mueller, but fire Justice Department officials
down the line,
who refused to fire Mueller, and then he fired Mueller. Other than that, anything related to the Russia investigation, anything related to obstruction of justice in connection with the firing of James Comey, I don't see any way this House of Representatives votes to impeach him.
The analogy here seems to be not so much Watergate as something you know even more about, but rather Iran-Contra, which had all kinds of secret machinations. It had hearings and, let's say, less than forthcoming generals and diplomatic back channels. The Reagan administration committed serious crimes, but was not impeached, not put in such serious jeopardy of its existence. It seems a little bit more.
I think that's a closer analogy. I think maybe this is because when I was one of the prosecutors in the Oliver North case, I like to remember that as a bigger victory than perhaps it was. And Reagan was damaged politically. I mean, he did not. The Iran-Contra case basically went from late '86 to through '88, the end of Reagan's second term, and he didn't get much done in those 2 years.
So, Jeff, if your best guess is that so long as the House of Representatives is safely Republican, Trump is pretty safe from impeachment, what are the odds and what has to happen in order for the House to turn Democratic?
Well, you have to have close to a political earthquake for the Democrats to pick up the number of seats that they need.
Like actual competitive elections.
Right. And the reason why that is so unlikely is because the congressional districts are gerrymandered to such a degree that the out party has very little chance of winning seats that the majority party holds.
Right. And the issue of gerrymandering is before the Supreme Court in a case called Gill versus Whitford, the big Wisconsin redistricting case. So what's at the core of this case and what's it all about? How does that affect things?
Well, this is, I think, the most important Supreme Court case in decades. And what it comes down to is this. Every 10 years following the census, state legislatures draw the lines for the House of Representatives federally and the state legislative bodies. Technology now exists so that the party in charge can draw lines with such precision that they can basically guarantee that certain seats will go to certain parties, that they can eliminate the possibility of competitive elections, and the party in power can protect their majority with exquisite precision.
But gerrymandering itself has been brought to the Supreme Court before, and how has the court historically dealt with the issue, and what do you expect to be the outcome here? Is Justice Kennedy yet again on the brink?
Even more than most cases, Kennedy is really holds the outcome because there is very little doubt, and I was at the oral argument of it. Four justices basically said, this is politics as usual. We should not get involved. Four justices said, we think this is just an outrageous, undemocratic process.
That's the liberal wing.
That's the liberal wing. And Kennedy, in the earlier gerrymandering cases, has said in effect, look, I don't think the case before us is one that requires the Supreme Court to get involved. But if it gets bad enough, I think the Supreme Court should get involved. So basically
it's a matter of degree then.
It's a matter of degree.
So when Chief Justice Roberts refers to sociological gobbledygook, what's he talking about?
Well, he's raising the hardest question for the plaintiffs in that case, which is, okay, you say this partisan gerrymandering is unacceptable. What's acceptable? We have to have the legislatures draw the lines. That's that's their job. What's the standard? What are they supposed to use? And this is a big problem for the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs have proposed some mathematical formulas, which are not exceptionally complicated, but the Supreme Court is made up of mostly liberal arts majors, as far as I can tell, and they don't know. They look at, oh, it's a Greek letter. I don't know what that means. And so this is a big problem for the plaintiffs in that case.
How are things? Why is it more of a mess now than it was then?
Because of technology.
It's just the power of computers.
Yes, but
to do a more precise carving up of the
right.
turkey.
Right, and as Paul Smith, the lawyers for the plaintiffs, pointed out, it's gotten considerably more sophisticated since 2010, the last time there was a census. So if the Supreme Court doesn't intervene in this case, after 2020, the gerrymandering problem is going to be worse than ever.
So I understand why gerrymandering keeps people in power and works to the benefit of the majority party.
Correct.
How is it responsible also to any degree to the horrible state of politics that we have?
Because when there are no competitive elections between the parties in most districts, congressional districts, state legislative districts, the only thing that incumbents have to fear is primaries from more extreme versions of their own parties. There is no incentive to compromise with the opposition party because you're not worried about losing the election to the opposition party. You're only worried about protecting your flank in your own party. And there is no doubt that all of this gerrymandering is responsible, at least in significant part, for the extreme polarization of state of legislative bodies.
And that flies in the face of what the framers intended, which was to reflect the changing moods of the country. In the not-so-distant past, how many seats would be competitive or change hands in an average election year as opposed to now?
Well, I mean, in the past, you could have 60 or 70 seats up for grabs out of the 435 in the House of Representatives.
And now how many might we see?
20 would be a lot.
20 out of the whole House being competitive.
Well, I mean, it's 20 switching hands would be a lot. It's virtually inconceivable that this that even in a landslide midterm election that many seats will switch, particularly because, you know, the 2010 election, which was such a disaster for the Democrats, and many important states, Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, became entirely controlled by Republicans. So they have drawn the lines for the last 10 years in those at least theoretically competitive states. That has locked in the Republican advantages in those seats.
So are Republicans better at this than Democrats, or it's just that they've been winning lately and therefore been able to take care of what you're describing as the technological revolution?
I think it's a combination of things. They are
and money's involved.
They're better at it. They have more money. They're also, as you go back, particularly in the 1990 and 1980 census, Republicans made alliances with African American politicians who wanted extreme incumbent protection. So what happened was in many states, especially in the South, Georgia, for example, the Republicans who were in control of the process said to the African American politicians, "We're going to give you super, super safe seats." So all the black voters, thus all the Democratic voters, were in a handful of seats where the incumbents won with 90% of the vote. But that meant that all the rest of the seats were drained of Democratic votes. So what you see throughout the South now is you have a handful of African American Democrats, and almost everyone else in the legislature is a white Republican. So that figures into this as well.
So over and over again during the campaign in 2016, Donald Trump would talk about how the whole thing is rigged. After the election, and I think with greater reason, the defeated Democratic candidate would talk about cheating vis-a-vis Russia or fake news or all the other mechanisms. And yet nobody before or after the election on any great national level, on the expert level, yes, but on any great, you know, public outcry was talking about gerrymandering. Why hasn't this gotten more attention? Is it too technical?
It's complicated. And it's just it's difficult to explain in a way that will motivate voters. It's also it doesn't have a simple solution. I mean, you know, the biggest way to address it is through the courts. And, you know, you don't mobilize voters by saying, you know, we're going to file a lawsuit under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I mean, it's just not something that motivates people.
So let's say Anthony Kennedy goes the way of the liberal wing of the court. What's going to change?
Something. It's actually quite simple. What would happen is what currently happens in two states, Iowa and California, where the parties name independent commissions. that are relatively neutral experts, and they draw the lines. And Iowa in particular, as a result of this, has very competitive congressional elections. California at the moment doesn't particularly because there's just no Republicans left in the state. You can't, you know, gerrymander people who don't live in the state into the state.
Right.
But Iowa, you know, has a really good system. And I think more states will be more or less compelled to use these commissions.
But Kennedy has to vote that way.
Kennedy has to vote that way.
And if he doesn't?
If he doesn't, it's the outcome of the 2020 elections will be even more enormously important because the opposition parties will jam the losing party even more than the Republicans did in 2011.
I have
now,
to ask
Democrat,
you.
Well, the Democrats also have a somewhat better chance than they did because they are looking better in the midterm elections of 2018. So they could elect governors of Michigan, Ohio, Florida that will give them a seat at the table in 2021, which they didn't have in 2011.
I have to close with a kind of general question. We're living at a moment when we're recognizing foreign interference in our democratic processes. We've just discussed gerrymandering and how that's distorted democracy. We're about to have a conversation about voter suppression, which a lot of people are very concerned about, and you've written about so well for mm-hmm. The New Yorker. One could be really pessimistic about the state of democracy and democratic processes with real reason in 2017, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, changes in policy when you know, one party comes in, the other party comes out. I don't think anyone feels there is anything undemocratic about that. But when you start to have the rules of the game change, you know, the rudiments of democracy, you know, who gets to vote, whether their vote counts, how difficult it is to register, whether your vote counts in a district or you're districted in so that your vote essentially doesn't count. Those sorts of changes really do go to the legitimacy of the whole system.
And,
that's scary.
And yet we have people, including the President of the United States, who think the biggest problem we have is voter fraud. And in just a minute, we're going to be looking very hard at that issue, too. Jeff, it's very good to talk to you as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for CNN. You can read him on the Supreme Court's redistricting case, Gill versus Whitford, at newyorkerradio.org. And that decision will be announced probably next summer at the end of the court's term. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For generations, the truth of American democracy has been that we seem not to like it very much. We don't act on it. Ask your fellow Americans to get out and vote, and it's a very tough sell, even in a presidential election where we vote at much lower rates than most Western democracies. Voter turnout in a country that prides itself as being one of the first democracies in the world is embarrassing and has been so for a long time. This isn't some new form of modern American cynicism. But in recent years, some in the political world have diagnosed a new problem. Too many people voting. Or maybe better put, the wrong kind of people.
The White House is standing by President Donald Trump's unsubstantiated claim that millions of people voted illegally in the November election.
Donald Trump is not the first person to claim that voter fraud is a serious problem. Chris Kobach, who now serves as vice chair of Trump's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, claimed in 2010 that in his home state of Kansas, as many as 2,000 people cast ballots using the names of dead voters.
When I was sworn in as Secretary of State in Kansas in January of 2011, my primary objective was to set about drafting the strongest anti-voter fraud law possible in any state, and to get it enacted and implemented as quickly as possible. And we succeeded in doing that.
Kobach went to work filing charges. As of now, there are 12 alleged cases of voter fraud. 12. Two of the first cases he filed were against Stephen and Betty Gatke.
My guess is that if Betty's had a speeding ticket, it was many, many years ago.
That's Betty Gatke's lawyer, Trey Petlin. He practices in Olathe, Johnson County, Kansas.
I defend people mostly in Kansas and Missouri in criminal cases, and I also handle personal injury cases.
And this was definitely Petlin's first case of voter fraud. Betty and Steve Gatke are both retired from the Postal Service.
Betty is a proud Native American Indian, a registered Republican. She's very civic-minded. And then Steve is a retired military.
In late 2015, an officer arrived at their house asking about the 2010 election, and then he had them arrested.
And the moment he read them their Miranda rights, I can tell you they were concerned. Originally, it was a charge that they had used an absentee ballot to double vote in Kansas when they had also voted in the election in Arkansas. They had to think back, but in 2010, they were in the process of moving. Betty had already moved to Arkansas. Steve still lived in Kansas, traveling to Arkansas quite a bit during this voting period. Ultimately, Betty never voted in Kansas. That was a mistake. She was innocent. Her case was dismissed. Steve voted by absentee ballot in Kansas, and he thought he could vote in Arkansas because he moved to Arkansas and he wasn't voting for any of the same candidates.
Voting crimes are often felonies, but Steve eventually pleaded guilty to a Class C misdemeanor, the lowest misdemeanor charge in Kansas.
Naturally, Steve and Betty were both embarrassed and disgruntled. You know, these are people that believe in the system and believe in the government. So they were disillusioned a little bit. And it was a difficult experience, I think, for both of them. And one of the things that I you know, in my research of all of this, as I was defending Betty, it was clear that voting crimes are extremely rare. not only had I not had one, I hadn't heard of one. I've done criminal defense for 23 years. It's not charged. And the reason it's not charged is because it doesn't happen.
That was Trey Petlin, a Kansas lawyer who defended one woman accused of voter fraud. Of the cases filed in Kansas, it appears that not one involves an undocumented immigrant. And maybe ironically, most of the accused were registered Republicans. But the issue has become a major talking point for conservatives. And one of the prominent voices on this is John Fund. Fund is a columnist for the National Review, an editor of the American Spectator, and he previously wrote for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of two books about threats to our voting system. Do you think voter impersonation is a problem of any scale?
I think in close elections where people know it's going to be close and decisive, I think their temptation, given how difficult it is to catch and detect, the temptation in certain close elections is overwhelming and presents a real danger in some elections where people get desperate and will use any methods. And by the way, voter fraud happens in both political parties. I can take you to counties in Kentucky where Republican voter fraud is rampant. And by the way, it's not $10 a vote. It's not $20 a vote. It's a bottle of bourbon.
So one study from Justin Levitt at Loyola Law School, on voting across the country between 2000 and 2014, 14 years, found exactly 31 instances of impersonation fraud out of a billion votes cast. Is that not a meaningful study?
No, because it's almost impossible to detect. You know, if you go to the Securities and Exchange Commission and you ask them, how many cases of insider trading violations do you have? They will tell you, we know there's a lot of them, but we know it's almost impossible to detect unless we have an informant or somebody squeals. So you could go and ask people how many insider trading convictions the SEC has conducted the last few years, and it's a small number.
No, a very small number.
If you go to the SEC,
studies, researchers at Wisconsin and Stanford have noted that the number of reported incidents of voter impersonation is about equal to the number of reported incidents of alien abduction. So what's going on? Do you think that these political scientists and the many, many others who have studied this issue are deliberately misrepresenting the facts?
No. What I'm saying is proving it, showing it is very difficult because once you put the ballot in the box, it's anonymous. So the only way to stop voter impersonation is to stop it from happening in the first place. Do we know how much there is? No, because it's almost impossible to detect and catch.
I want to ask you about the National Voter Registration Act, what people usually call the motor voter law. George H.W. Bush, the senior Bush, refused to sign it. But it went into law during the Clinton administration, and Republicans have been fighting about it ever since. What, in your view, is the problem with the law?
Enforcement.
Yes.
Well, of course we want people to be able to register to vote easily. We even give them postcards to do it. The postcards are standardized. That's fine. But we gave the state the responsibility to keep their voter rolls clean. And the federal government had the responsibility to sue the states if they didn't keep their voter rolls clean. So this is part of the law that means, of course, it should be easy to register to vote. But if people don't vote or they're voting illegally over an extended period of time or their names are no longer valid, we have to cull the rolls. There has been no enforcement of that since 2008.
John, at one point you claimed that thanks to the motor voter law, 8 of the 9/11 hijackers were registered to vote. This is you talking about that on Morning Joe some years ago.
8 of the 9/11 hijackers, 8 of the 19 hijackers were registered to vote because they'd gotten driver's licenses.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Now, that's a pretty explosive claim. It's also not true, but it gets to one of the arguments you've made about the motor voter law, that linking the voter registration process to the process of getting a license could lead to abuse. Do you think that
David, let me explain. Do you think that it's too easy
to register to vote in this country?
You've accused me of reporting a falsehood. I would simply tell you some of them. It was not 8. It was a lower number.
What was the number?
You're asking me to report something that was 15 years old.
But what's the number? If it's a lower number than 8, what is the number?
Well, give me time to research it then, because you're asking me a question out of the blue after 15 years. How much do you remember of what you reported 15 years ago?
Quite a lot.
Well, you have a better memory than I do. My source was someone inside the Justice Department, a top official. Obviously, it was on background, and I can't give you that person's name.
But it was wrong.
Certainly the number was wrong, yes. It was not that high.
Were any of them?
Yes. We know several of them have driver's licenses. We know that. They were driving.
One reason election officials are cautious about trying to clean up the registration polls is because of the real risk of mistakenly purging rightfully registered voters, right? Here in New York, our City Board of Elections just admitted it accidentally purged more than 100,000 voters from the rolls last year. Are you worried about that, too?
Well, that is why over a third of my book involves cases of bureaucratic incompetence. I actually believe we need to spend more money and more resources and take more care with our elections. We need to have more sophisticated voting machines rather than the tinker toy things that we buy. And we need to have better voter rolls. And we need to also train a whole new generation of poll workers, because the average generation of poll workers we have now working the polls is 70 years old. They're not going to be with us forever.
I guess, John, what I want to know is, do you think that there's a really concerted effort afoot of real voter fraud? I'm not saying that there aren't isolated incidents. We can agree on that, and we know that the numbers of it are quite small, to the point of insignificance, the way I see it. But do you really think that there's a concerted effort to vote illegally in this country, and that's significant, and that is something that should be a consuming national issue, as opposed to voter suppression on the other side of the coin?
I think as Chris Dodd, the senator from Connecticut, who was the co-sponsor of the Help America Vote Act, the last bipartisan legislation in this, he said, we can do both things at the same time. We can make it easy to vote, and we can make it hard to cheat. I agree with Chris Dodd. What I want to emphasize here is there's common ground, but there are people here who don't want us to reach common ground, some on the right and some on the left. Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, Andy Young had a civil rights conference 2.5 years ago in Austin, Texas. They proposed the Freedom Card. They said we shouldn't be spending all of this money on lawsuits and, you know, who has a voter ID and who doesn't. Let's create a Freedom Card. Let's convert the Social Security card into an ID card for voting purposes only with a photograph on it. The cost would be minimal. And let's issue that to everyone who doesn't have an ID. Because as Andy Young told me, if people don't have an ID in this country, I don't know how many there are, but if anyone who does, they can't participate in the mainstream of American life. They can't travel. They can't get government benefits. They can't cash a check. Let's get them an ID. And I have proposed this to many of the civil rights groups that are fighting these laws. Let's not fight about whether there should be a law. Let's get everyone an ID. I've had very little interest in this. They apparently want to spend their money on litigation and lawsuits.
John, do you think that the federal government should be at the center of this? Would that be a good way to standardize?
No, because the Constitution argues against that. The Constitution specifically lodges responsibility for the time, manner, and place of elections with the states.
A big reason supporters of Trump's commission say that we need to focus on looking into this problem is because nobody knows exactly how many votes are cast fraudulently. It's true that it's very difficult to account for every single ballot every single year. That's absolutely true. But isn't saying nobody knows how much fraud there is just a way to sow doubt in the system and justify putting up barriers to vote, which also happens? Is it possible to know anything about this?
We don't know how much tax evasion there is in this country, but we try to have a good faith effort to try to put up enough risks for people that no one will commit tax evasion lightly. We don't catch nearly as many people as practice tax evasion, but at least they know there's some consequences for some people.
Do you think this issue is as important as what we've experienced in 2016, the issue of hacking?
I'm as concerned about the Russian hacking of our elections or the attempted hacking as I am of the mass unmasking of people caught up in NSA surveillance dragnets by Samantha Power and other officials in the Obama administration. I think both are of concern and we both should look at them.
John Fund, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Fund is author of Stealing Elections and co-author of Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk.
The argument that voter fraud is meant to be concealed, therefore you can't find it, is sort of ridiculous. I mean, all crimes are meant to be concealed.
Right.
So
kind of money laundering is meant to be concealed.
Right, you know, or any kind of a fraud is meant to be concealed. So we have that challenge with all kinds of crimes and fraud and detecting them. And we have methods for doing that.
Lorraine Menidi is a professor of political science who spent years researching claims of fraud in our electoral system. Her conclusions are apparent right from the title of her 2010 book, The Myth of Voter Fraud. She spoke with New Yorker staff writer Jelani Cobb.
So, Lorraine, what did you find when you started looking into claims of voter fraud?
Well, I should say it was a really difficult research project because there isn't a singular kind of a database that tracks cases of voter fraud. So I had to go through a process of looking for it where I thought it would show up. So I would start with asking secretaries of state and attorneys generals in the state, and I sent a survey to every district attorney in the United States. I asked them, you know, how many cases do you have of XYZ, you know, registration fraud, of double voting, of voter impersonations. I did interviews with election officials, and I just kept looking and looking and looking and couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. And you know, I will say, since 2010, when my book was published, I have served as an expert witness in 8 federal voting rights cases and a state case. So there have been 9 cases that have been dealing with, say, challenges to voter ID laws. You can read the legislative record in the states when they debate the voter ID laws that have been passed. You can look at the court records on these cases. No state has been able to show that they've had any kind of a problem with voter fraud. So it's not just me, you know, looking for it and maybe making mistakes somehow and not finding it. I mean, I have looked for years, and I have looked in multiple ways, and I have tried to reason through where would it show up if it were happening and look there. And no one else has come up with it.
But you take a pretty significant stand on it. I mean, the title of the book is The Myth of Voter Fraud.
Right.
And
right.
So if this is a kind of mythology, then what exactly are we talking about here?
Well, I think it's tapping into attitudes that are you know, really deep in American culture and racially charged and class-based attitudes that, you know, certain people shouldn't be allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so we perpetuate the idea that there's all this corruption, and that justifies stricter rules about access, and that those stricter rules have disproportionate effects on people who are poor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So as we talk, there is the kind of swirling issue of the presidential voter fraud initiative and Kris Kobach attempting to get voter data from the various states. And if voter fraud is not common or rare in American politics, why does it have the kind of political appeal that it does?
Well, I think there's a kind of institutional bias in our party system. We have this party system with two parties. We don't have proportional representation. We have winner take all. So the logic of that is that you just have to get one more vote than your opponent. That creates incentives to think about demobilizing your opponent's voters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is targeting a particular population. You might call it the more marginal population in the United States because it has a partisan overlay. Those people are perceived to be more friendlier to the Democratic Party. And so you have the Republican Party, almost everywhere these laws have been adopted in the United States, pushing for voter ID laws, proof of citizenship laws, because there's an electoral advantage to them if they can keep down the vote of the opponents rather than try to enlarge their majority around their own, you know, policy agenda. So, you know, it's got a very partisan overlay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's interesting that there's this long history that we can look at with African Americans, particularly around poll taxes and grandfather clauses and literacy tests and outright physical intimidation to prevent people from voting. But we've also seen that language applied increasingly to Latinos, particularly around the idea of people who are undocumented, who are participating in the electoral system. And one of the things I think I found interesting in your book was you talking about the idea of voter fraud being fundamentally more irrational an act than voting itself is. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. It's in the sort of professional study of politics by political scientists, scholars, analysts sort of apply the idea of costs and benefits to voting. And they sort of count up the benefits, and then they look at the cost. And the cost would be in time or effort or, you know, education. You have resources and so forth. And they sort of come to a conclusion that actually it's not that rational for any individual, you know, to vote, especially, say, in a national election, because the likelihood of your one vote determining the outcome is so small that you would say, well, why bother, right? And so the question of committing voter fraud says, well, let's take an almost irrational act, which is voting, and then to say, and, you know, what I'm then going to do is I'm going to break a law. I'm going to possibly face, you know, even a felony conviction. If I am a non-citizen or certainly an undocumented non-citizen, I'm going to face deportation to cast one more vote. What do you get for it? You know, what do you actually get for your voting? So
well, let me say the opposite, the other side of this. You know, in 2012, when Mitt Romney was questioned about why he thought he lost, he made the indelicately phrased statement about Obama having given massive financial gifts to minorities. Isn't that part of the equation when people talk about this, about what the person would benefit would be? There's some guy in a seedy part of town with an envelope full of cash, and he's just kind of distributing it around to get people to show up to vote?
Well, there are cases of that. I mean, there are cases of something called vote buying, and in particular in some poor, isolated communities, there have been examples, you know, even not that long ago, of exactly what you just described, which the problem with that is that with the secret ballot, it's not a very efficient way of trying to rig an election because, you know, anybody could take the money and go in and vote any way you want, right? So how do you guarantee that you're getting what you're paying for? So that's another example of why this is sort of, you know, boneheaded a thing to do.
I do want to think about this historically, though, for a minute. You started this work in 2000, but there have been, you know, scandals and questions around voter integrity in the United States for a long time. And we could look at Tammany Hall or, you know, Huey Long, that kind of incandescently colorful figure of Louisiana politics as well.
No, in the past, we certainly have a colorful history of electoral manipulation, of election fraud broadly, of stealing of ballots and so forth. But that's not where we're at today. Many things have changed since the 19th century and even since, you know, the 1920s and the 1930s.
Or even going back to the colonial era,
where
you know, candidates would, you know, for the colonial legislatures would kind of literally go to the saloons and, you know, get everyone beer and then roll them over to the ballots.
Yes, yeah, so this is very entertaining and interesting history. But even those stories we can tell about Tammany Hall or about even Lyndon Johnson's, everybody likes to talk about Lyndon Johnson's first race for Senate when, you know, mysteriously the voters of Alice, Texas kind of lined up in alphabetical order to sign in.
So that is a testament to great local party organization.
That's right.
One of the points that you raise in your book that I found really interesting was about this myth that the 8, I think, of the 19 hijackers on September 11th were registered voters, or this said some, which I hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. I read your book, but as I was reading this, I thought, you know, of course someone has said this. This is like, why would someone not make up this idea? But this was an idea that was going around, and it became kind of a stand-in for people's fears about having, I guess, a voting system that was too lax.
Yes, yeah, and that was partly, we can trace it right to the motor voter law, mm-hmm. right, which mandates that state agencies that do motor vehicles provide an opportunity for people to register to vote. You know, this was a signature feature of that 1993 piece of legislation. It was one of the first bills that Bill Clinton signed. It was either the first or the second. So, you know, the sort of conservative right-wing, you know, people who went after Clinton his whole time in office were pretty obsessed with the National Voter Registration Act and the idea that it would allow for fraudulent registrations, illegal registrations, mistakes, problems. They're going to pollute the registration rolls. So this idea that the 9/11 hijackers were registered to vote came in part because some of them had used fake driver's licenses, or I think in some cases there were some who had actually legally obtained mm-hmm. driver's licenses. So the question was, hey, if they got a driver's license, they had to have been asked, would you like to register to vote? So they could be registered to vote. They are registered mm-hmm. to vote, you know, was said on, you know, a couple of television mm-hmm. shows in particular.
And this turns out to not be true.
Right.
What do you think we'll see from this commission that's being led by Kris Kobach?
Well, I think we'll see more of what certainly I've seen and other people who study this issue have seen happen, which is to mash up a lot of data as a pretext to arguing that the voter rolls are so polluted and corrupted and, you know, people could be lurking around using false IDs to come in or false names, you know, to get on the rolls and then register. And so, I mean, I think it's about trying to create ongoing chaos on election day in a way. You know, in other words, create an environment in which the public actually is losing confidence, not gaining confidence. I don't think the public is going to gain confidence from whatever comes out of that commission.
So the book is The Myth of Voter Fraud by Lorraine Menidi. And thank you. It's a very pertinent topic. Thank you
You're
for
welcome.
Coming in to talk with us today.
Lorraine Menidi, a professor of political science at Rutgers University. She spoke with Jelani Cobb of The New Yorker. Ahead this hour, fiction writer George Saunders talks about the inspiration for his first novel, which covers one very dark night in the life of Abraham Lincoln. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
George Saunders is the author of countless short stories, really one of the great writers of our time, and a huge influence on other writers, on younger writers especially. His work is very funny and also very sad, and at the center of it is a deep concern with morality, how the world constantly gets in the way of our desire to be good spouses, good friends, good neighbors, good colleagues. George Saunders' first novel just won the prestigious Man Booker Prize. And earlier this year, right around the time the novel was published, Saunders talked to us about the inspiration for the novel, how it came to be. The book is called Lincoln in the Bardo.
So for the past 5 years, I've been working on this novel called Lincoln in the Bardo. And this statue has just been kind of a constant reminder that I have that at home to work on. And kind of also a bit of a physical embodiment of the kind of ethos of the book, which is Lincoln kind of at his lowest, you know, the most sad, the most defeated. It's 1862, the war is going terribly. They're just realizing it's not going to be a short thing. And, you know, these reports are coming back of thousands of people dead in a single day. And at this moment, his favorite child dies at 11, kind of unexpectedly of typhus. And he was so heartsick, according to newspapers at the time, that he actually went back to the graveyard one night alone and held a body. So the book is kind of set on that night. So his hands are crossed, kind of in his lap. And he looks like he just came from court, maybe. He's kind of dressed up. He's got his bow tie on, no beard. And he's sitting with his knees slightly apart, his hands between his knees. And his eyes are cast down at about, you know, a spot a few feet in front of himself in what looks to me kind of like almost like a meditative posture. I've heard that it's the only sad sculpture of Lincoln that exists. And he looks kind of contemplative and a little sad, a little bummed out. And he just looks kind of like he's working through something. But maybe, you know, it's funny, there was, you think of the Rodin, the thinker, and that guy is working it. You know, he's kind of hunched over and he's looks a little constipated. And this is a different kind of a thinking. He seems to be kind of there, you know, to receive thought, but not pushing it too hard. You know, he's letting the solution kind of work its way up through himself a little bit. At least that's how I see it. I don't know. He might be asleep for all I know. In truth, the meaningful thing about this was that it was like a physical embodiment of this secret project that for about half the time I wasn't sure would work. So I can remember kind of walking by and going, I'm trying, you know, I'm doing my best. You know, the book is about the night that supposedly Lincoln went to the crypt and held his son's body a couple nights after he was buried. So the book sort of became, I guess, an exploration of how, you know, how do we function when everything's really broken? The country's turned against him. He really is losing the war. So his son died, and it was kind of connected with a party that they had thrown. The kids were sick, and they went ahead with the party anyway. So when the kid finally did pass away, there was a lot of chatter about the bad parenting of the Lincolns and the ambition and so on. So your son dies, you have a feeling that you maybe helped it along, maybe. Then you're so grief-stricken, you hold the body. Well, the next day he went into the office and he signed some big bill changing the currency or something like that. So he had some way of enduring hardship, and it was really interesting to think about what would one do in that situation where every vestige of defense that you would build up would crumble under your feet. There's nothing he could claim for himself, really. And yet, as we know, he went on. So it was funny how as the book started to become that story, I would look out and he would be in exactly the posture that I would imagine him being at the graveyard, and exactly in the kind of the frame of mind. He looks a little bit like somebody who's just been beaten at something, you know, just lost something. He
you know, I'd never really wanted to write about Lincoln. It's like, who wants to write about Lincoln? It's like writing about Jesus, you know, it's too hard. You know, you're trying to avoid 4 score and 7 minutes ago I came into this graveyard, you know. But it's funny how there is, you know, I think one of the reasons people love him, I think it has to do with he just was, you get the sense anyway, he's just working through these things on a really high moral ethical level by his own lights, you know, which is really something moving about that, that he could change the world just by reasoning his way through it, you know. The thing, okay, so the thing about Lincoln that's remarkable when you read through that period, he always seemed to have, in a moment of crisis, to keep his eyes up on the higher things. So, there was a point where things were getting really ugly, a lot of casualties and no progress either way. So it looked like it'd be a 20-year war of attrition. And there was some talk about a peace deal. And one of the conditions was the Emancipation Proclamation would be struck down, the slaves would be returned, and he wouldn't do it. It wasn't political, it wasn't expedient, but he had spoken to some of the black veterans who had fought, and he's just like, we can't do it. It's not possible. You know, at a moment when it's sometimes the eternal verities seem trivial or they seem impossible, that's the time to double down on them, you know. So if we believe that love is the answer, it is. And if we believe that vigilance is necessary, then it is. I think Twain said, you know, an untested virtue is not a virtue. You know, we like it to be tested in miniature, so we can always win. You know, we can always be confident of who we are. And I mean, we don't like ambiguity. We don't like this feeling right now because it's so uncertain. Not only is it uncertain what's going to happen, but our place in it is uncertain. And I guess what I see in his posture is somebody who knows that there's no autopilot. There's also something about him being all right with how things are at the moment. We're inclined to think that if we're sad, we've messed up or we've lost or we've been shown to be incorrect. But in a lot of Eastern teachings, the, you know, sadness is, that's right. Yeah, you know, you're dying and you're inept while you're here and you're failing at love. And why wouldn't you be sad?
George Saunders is the author of several books of short stories and one novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, which just won the Man Booker Prize. He spoke with us from the statue of Lincoln outside his office in Syracuse, New York. If you want to hear more from George Saunders, you might want to listen to The New Yorker's fiction podcast. It's a who's who of the writers of our time, reading and discussing some of their favorite stories from The New Yorker's archive. If you haven't heard it, this is a great time to dive in because we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the fiction podcast hosted by Deborah Treisman, who's our fiction editor. You can hear Richard Ford, Anne Enright, Nathan Englander, and Mary Gateskill each reading a different story by John Cheever, or Antonia Nelson, Margaret Atwood, and Karen Russell explaining what they learned from Mavis Gallant. We're taking a poll of your favorites, so listen and vote. It's all at newyorker.com/podcast. And I'm David Remnick. We're done for today. That's it. Thank you so much for being here. And come back next week when Adam Davidson will talk about love, war, and sandwiches. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.